Applicants call Dr. Thomas Hardy.
Dr. Hardy, if you'd please come forward, sir, and raise your right hand and be sworn.
Dr. Hardy, tell us your full name, please.
Thomas Byron Hardy.
And let's have you summarize your professional background, starting with what you're doing right now.
Currently, I am the Chief Science Officer at the Meadows Center for Water and the Environment and will be named the Endowed Professor of Environmental Flows at Texas State University under the Meadows Grant. Prior to moving to Texas in 2009, I was the Associate Director of the Utah Water Research Laboratory, where I went on faculty in 1988 and became a full-tenure professor, and was the Director of the Institute for Natural Systems Engineering, which I started in 1989.
That was at Utah State?
Yes, sir.
Hi.
Hi, John.
Tell me about your particular specialties.
You achieved a PhD?
Yes, my PhD is in civil and environmental engineering with an emphasis in water resources. My master's is in aquatic ecology. One of my bachelor's is biology. My second bachelor's is in secondary education. And my professional career basically can be characterized as looking at impact assessments in river corridors on changes of flow and aquatic biota, riparian systems, fish, macroinvertebrates.
All right. Would you tell the court about your experience in particular with the Colorado River and its tributaries, the whole system?
Back in the late 1980s, at the time that the Bureau was beginning to evaluate use of rotary wing aircraft, helicopters, and videography in order to determine backwater presence in area, a colleague of mine, Dr. Christopher Neal, and I at Utah State University were flying a fixed-wing remote sensing aircraft with red, green, and near-infrared imagery, and we were evaluating the use of image processing techniques rather than manually delineating backwater systems and comparing it to the work of Mr. Pucciarelli, which will be referred to in the backwater areas. Also was involved in a team while in grad school. I worked full-time for a consulting firm called BioWest in Logan, Utah, and we put together basically with a group of species experts in the basin a document on the habitat suitability curves of the endangered species of the Upper Colorado River Basin. Habitat suitability curves indicate what depth or what velocities are preferred by the various endangered species, by adult, by spawning, juveniles, or young of the year. I've worked extensively on hydropower relicensing and water diversions in the Duchesne, the Uinta River, et cetera, in the basin.
Now, Blue Castle has asked you to testify concerning stream environment and public recreation issues in connection with these applications. Is that right?
Correct.
All right, let's talk about stream environment. Well, to some extent, they're going to overlap, but would you describe for the court how you set about beginning your analysis, the methodology that you applied, looking at the question of the impact on the Green River, in particular, of the 70 CFS diversion proposed by these applications? Explain how you went about your work and the methodology.
I was tasked with evaluating a constant 70 CFS withdrawal from the river. So the first thing I did was download the daily flow gauge record, the same as Jerry Oles was using, and did the same thing he did independently, and that was subtract 70 CFS from every daily flow, and then looked at the period of record, calculated the flow duration curves for the system with the existing flows or with 70 CFS being withdrawn on every day instantaneously. I then went further to evaluate from the available USGS gauge at Green River the actual field data that was available on the relationship between stage, which is basically depth in the river, and discharge width and discharge relationships, velocity and discharge relationships, cross-sectional area discharge relationships, to try to understand then how over a range of discharges and over time, those would potentially be impacted by a 70 CFS reduction in flow.
All right. Now, was there anything particularly new or unusual about the methodology you applied to this?
No, the standard technique, it is what we call hydraulic geometry equations at a station, which is simply that the stage or depth varies with the power law of the discharge. So stage equals a coefficient A times the discharge raised to an exponent. Basically,
standard formula.
Standard formula that's been in use since the seminal work by Leopold and Maddox in the 1940s. There are three equations we commonly use. That is that stage is a power law of discharge, width is a power law of discharge, and velocity is a power law of discharge. Those are called the continuity equations. Because if you add the coefficients, you get one. If you multiply the exponents, if you multiply the coefficients, you get one. Standard hydrology engineering practice.
When you use the phrase discharge, what do you mean?
Cubic feet per second passing a point in the stream, such as the gauge at Green River.
It could be any point, but in this case, it happened to be the gauge.
Because that is the place where we have empirical data where USGS has gone out and said, oh, the height of the water on the gauge is 5.32, and then they would measure verticals across the river to determine the estimate of the discharge. Excuse me. They would come back a month later where the stage had changed. They would remeasure the discharge. And they would do that repeatedly to develop what is called a stage discharge rating curve.
And the discharge rate, we're talking in terms of cubic feet per second?
Yes, sir.
And you also testified at the administrative hearing before the state engineer.
Yes, sir.
In connection with these applications.
Yes, sir.
What is a rating curve?
At any gauging station in particular, you usually have a device, whether it's a pressure transducer or some kind of a stilling well with a laser that is recording the height or stage of the water every 15 minutes typically. That's not giving you the discharge, it's simply giving you the height of the water. USGS goes to the site and on a given day says what's 5.62 and they measure the discharge. They come back and they say, oh, it's at 6.3 and the discharge is 5,000. They come back a month later and the gauge is 3.2, oh, the discharge is 700. So you develop a set of pairs of stage and of discharge that you then, using a regression equation, you fit that data to a power law, and that is what's called a rating curve. Therefore, for each measurement of the stage, you can put it into the equation and get an estimate of the discharge, and that is how USGS then gives you every 15 minutes times 24 hours a day divided by 96 gives you the mean daily flow at the gauge.
And it's pretty common for these kinds of gauges to have live telemetry. You could go online right now, for example, and see what's happening at some of these gauges. Is that
correct?
Right?
And that is because it is reading the stage. It is sending the number of the stage to the computer. The computer takes that number and puts it in the regression equation, and then it puts a dot on the plot that tells you what the discharge is.
So you could take a real-time snapshot of lots of different sources, whether it's the Green River, the Colorado, or others.
Correct.
And how this concept of a rating curve, how did you apply it here to this particular withdrawal from the Green River in your analysis?
The first thing I did was, for any given river, you need to, except if it was purely bedrock, the geometry of the channel changes over time. The Green River, in particular, is a sand bed river. And so if you pull down from the internet at the USGS site, you will find a number of what we call rating curve numbers. And that is where in 1973 they went out and they measured stage and discharge, and they did that over several months, and they would have a set of data that they developed a curve to, call it rating curve number 7. a flood goes through and changes that geometry, they start over and collect data and develop a new rating curve. So that's rating curve number 8. And if you download the data from the gauge, you will see there are a number of rating curves. First thing I did was plot those individual rating curves because I know as the sand bed river is going to change.
Explain that. What do you mean by that?
The slope of the water surface elevation, given the geometry, may be a little steeper or a little less steep depending upon the geometry.
And is that because simply the action of the water on the sand, sediment load, other things can affect what the bottom of the river looks like?
High flow or low flows may result in changes in the geometry of the channel. At higher flows, it can scour out, move to the left, move to the right a little bit. It can, at lower flows, make mid-channel bars that would change that relationship. And since I was evaluating a potential change in the discharge for the future, one question I asked myself, well, if I use the most current rating curve, someone might say, well, it's not going to look like that because you know it's different from 1973. It's a different rating curve. So I looked at all the different rating curves and decided that the best estimate of future conditions was to incorporate the variability of all of the rating curves in my analysis, which is what I did. And it resulted in some interesting features about that relationship between stage and discharge at the gauge.
Okay, and we're going to get to some exhibits that will illustrate this, but I just want to lay this foundation. Would you define or explain the terms exceedance or exceedance level?
Yes, just like Mr. Olds presented in his testimony and exhibit, if you take all of the known discharges on a given day, for every day at the gauge, and you rank them highest to lowest, it's what's called the Weibull formula. You take, rank them number one, the highest flow, two, three, and you have, say, 5,000 measurements. Well, you do 1 divided by 5,001, the second rank, 2 divided by 5,001. And that tells you the percent of time that a flow is equaled or exceeded. So high flows at a 10% exceedance, say 24,000 CFS at the Green River gauge, that flow is equaled or exceeded only 10% of the time. It's a rare flow. It's a high flow.
Okay.
Opposite end and low flows, a very low flow, 95% exceedance might be 1,000. 1,000 CFS is equaled or exceeded 95% of the time. The converse of that coin is it's only lower than that 5%.
5%. Okay. And lastly, in terms of just sort of defining some terms, explain backwater, what a backwater is, and backwater delineation. How does that work?
A backwater would represent an area of the channel where typically they're very low or no velocity areas. They typically have formed in areas where you have some type of a nick point or an area where you get what we call flow separation. The water's coming down, you get an opening of the channel to the side like a dry wash, and you get the classic separation where you get a recirculation zone like a whirlpool. The velocities slow down. The suspended sediment falls out. That's where you get beaches. And then they also have the feature, because of that, where you get a backwater when the flow recedes. Then you get this ponded area that's open, typically at the downstream side, although they can be open on the front side. That's just pure geomorphology and movement of sediment and the dynamics. And that's how they're created. Those are important areas for fisheries, for young of the year, rearing habitats, etc. But those are the mechanisms that are formed, but they're typically formed during the high flow process. Hence, in the recovery implementation program, under extremely dry, average year, wet years, they have different levels of higher flows to basically move the sediment and create the characteristics of the channel. And most of those flows are in the 8,000 CFS range and higher under the recovery implementation program.
Okay.
And delineation is either done taking a picture and using professional judgment, or you can empirically go down the river and physically try to measure the location and size of each of the backwaters. The work that's been done in the Green primarily has been done from photo interpretation or interpretation of video imagery.
Okay. What section of the Green River did you evaluate in connection with this proposed diversion for the Blue Castle project?
It would be in the vicinity of Green River where the proposed diversion was located, to the confluence with the Colorado River, which is approximately 120 miles.
And is that Reach 3 of the river?
That is what is commonly referred to as Reach 3 in the Recovery Implementation Program documentation.
And what was the maximum diversion rate you were asked to consider out of the Green River?
A 70 cubic feet per second continuous instantaneous diversion rate.
And the gauge you relied on, I think you already said, was the gauge at Green River?
Yes, sir.
USGS?
Yes, sir.
And the types of data, I think you've probably covered it, width, stage, discharge, what other kinds of data factor into your analysis?
One of the first things I did was went to Google Earth and looked at all the available imagery by moving down the river section by section and looking at how the river changed. For each of the dates of the imagery, I went back to the gauge to see what the flow rate was. Oh, on September 6, 2004, it was Green River gauge was 1,250. Oh, I have high water in this imagery. It was 2006 on that day. The flow was 8,000 something CFS. So I just wanted to see what the physical dynamics were. Because I had gone back and pulled information such as Mike Pucciarelli's work in 1988 and 1989, where they used imagery to actually delineate the size and basic location of backwaters, I wanted to see what that looked like relative to new imagery that was available. And I also went back and read available information from the Recovery Implementation Program, for example, data by Hines and Tyus, or Tyus and Hines and others, on distribution and use of backwaters by the endangered species, so I could understand better the linkage between the physics of backwaters, their location, their characteristics, and the implication of removing 70 CFS potentially on those features that are important to the fish.
All right. And how would you characterize the specific analysis that you applied to the types of data that you just described?
Well, first of all, I could not find any real cross-section morphology data other than general characteristics of the backwaters, like maximum depth or size and area of the backwaters. There wasn't any specific geometry that I could rely upon except what was available at the gauge. So I took the field measurements at the gauge, as I indicated. I did obtain from USGF some hand-measured cross-section geometry in the vicinity of the gauge, measured at different discharges, and in particular, one measurement at 900 and something CFS and another measurement at 700 CFS, which is very much the lowest flow basically recorded in the preceding period of records. So that was very important to me to see what it looked like. I then conducted the basic analysis of the stage discharge, depth discharge, by removing that regression and then removing 70 CFS. I repeated that analysis for width, I repeated that analysis for velocity, I repeated the analysis for cross-sectional area. I used the mean velocity to infer from my experience potential impacts to fish, macroinvertebrates, or travel time for recreation. I looked at the changes in stage and depth and its implication perhaps on implications to backwater impacts for the endangered fish, etc.
So it's possible to actually calculate, you mentioned recreation. So someone who wants to, say, float the river, you can actually calculate the velocity change that a withdrawal of 70 CFS out of a river that, say, might have 5,000 CFS going through at a given time. You can actually, there's a formula that will let you calculate this, the velocity loss.
The velocity is equal to a coefficient times the discharge raised to a power, one of the continuity equations. So that gives me mean channel velocity. So if I change the flow, I can calculate the change in velocity. And as a whitewater rafter and a river guide, I know how boats float on rivers, so it's a pretty good idea that if I'm in the center of the channel and I'm floating how much does that velocity change the rate I'm moving down the river? And that was the basis upon which I addressed one of the issues in this proceeding, and that is what is the potential impact on rafting.
Right. But and the formula is a standard formula.
That is the basic continuity equations is stage versus discharge, velocity versus discharge, and width versus discharge.
And how would you characterize the variability in the physical data you relied on at the gauge?
As would be expected, I can refer to an exhibit. I think it would help explain to the court. The variability at the higher range of the discharges is higher. That's to be expected because of the magnitude of the flows, those geomorphic flows. If you've ever stood on a river at high flow, you can hear it pulsing. You can see the water bouncing. And so if you're measuring the stage, you're going to get more variability. That's the way rivers operate. But what was interesting at the Green River gauge, and it's not uncommon, is that as you got into the low flow, below, say, 5,000 CFS, where one might be more concerned about impacts, the variability is very much diminished.
Okay. And also, how would you characterize the general sources for biological data that you considered in your assessment? And by biological data, I think what we're talking about is living things in the river.
Right. We know from the work that's been done in the recovery implementation program, the integrated monitoring program, we pretty much know when razorback suckers are using backwaters during the high flow spring period. They tend to move out afterwards. We know that Colorado pike minnow, the one probably fish of major concern, migrating upstream in the reach one and reach two to spawn, and then the larval fish drifting downstream in the May, June period coming out, and then really rearing in the lower section three of the Green River in these ephemeral backwater side channel type of habitats. And the data on collections of the biological data showing use in these backwaters, along with large numbers of non-native fish. What was important to me is that the work showing that as you increase the depth of the backwaters, the maximum depth, the number of Colorado pike minnow you find increases. And the average depth of those maximum depths of the backwaters is on the order of, any, depending upon the study, whether it's Haynes and Tyus or Tyus and Haynes, maybe anywhere from 29 to 38 centimeters as being the type of backwaters being used. Well, that's a foot of water at least. And in my analysis of the changes in stage that are less than an inch, it had a large bearing on my assessment of what impacts I may or may not have.
Okay. And what about water temperature?
I discounted an impact to water temperature from the physics of the situation, where I've got flows on the low end that are 1,000 cubic feet per second. The thermal mass is what we call it. If I take a teaspoon of water and put a Bic lighter on it, it heats up really quick and it cools off really quick. If I take a Bic lighter and hold it under a swimming pool, it doesn't heat up very fast and it doesn't cool down very fast. And so the thermal characteristics of the lower river with the canyons re-radiating heat, my professional opinion as an engineer and do water quality modeling is that the amount of temperature differences between removal of 70 CFS was not going to be something you may even be able to measure. You may be able to calculate a change, but realistically, you're not going to be able to see it.
Okay. All right, let's talk about, well, actually, let me ask you this. Regarding physical impacts to the river, based on your analysis, what did you conclude that the effect the 70 CFS would have on the river?
I said it was de minimis, and I broke it into two components. One was a high flow component. Under the long-term gauge data, you look year-to-year, spring runoff flows. The recovery implementation program for dry years recommend 8,000 cubic feet per second for the geomorphic flows, you go up to an average year and it's 12,000 something, 24,000, 70 CFS being removed from the river at 8,000 CFS is less than 1%.
And you're using the figure of 8,000 CFS why?
Cubic feet per second at the Green River gauge, for example.
Right.
If you took 70 CFS out of the river when it's flowing 8,000 CFS, it's less than 1% of the flow. I would challenge anybody to measure that with the technology we have today. At the water lab, if we wanted that kind of accurate measurement, we weighed the water. You're not going to weigh the water in the Green River at 8,000 cubic feet per second.
Okay.
And from a sediment transport perspective, the stream power to move sand at those sort of flow rates, and you remove 70, you would be into the third or fourth significant digit after the decimal point on the amount of material you're going to move. Based on that, I also work with a team in the Snake River Basin adjudication that has some of the most prominent geomorphologists in the country: Peter Whiting, Jack King, Jack Schmidt, Bill Emmett, John Pagiani, myself, and we were tasked with how would you divert flow from the river that would preserve the formation of beaches and backwaters in scenic and wild rivers in Idaho? That's the same physical process by which you form backwaters and beaches in the Green River. Our conclusion, after intensive study of sediment transport, we went out and measured bed load, measured suspended load, we did the modeling equations, and we basically came to the conclusion that the safest thing was the removal instantaneously of no more than 10% of the flow. Well, clearly in the Green River, that had a large impact on my view of the river, because I'm less at geomorphic flows, I'm less than 1%, even at the lowest geomorphic flows. I then flipped the coin and said, during the low flow period, that same logic holds, because all the way down to the 95% exceedance, very, very low flows, I'm still taking less than 10% of the flow. That made me very comfortable that I'm okay in preserving the process.
So you didn't, at no time are we at risk of crossing that 10% threshold
that
you identified in your Idaho study?
No, sir, we are not. The second part of that was actually looking at the computed regression equation on change in stage if I remove 70 CFS. And that was on the order, even at the lowest flow, of an inch. And I just could not conceive how that would, over all of the different variability of backwaters. That was a conservative number because my regression equation slope is greater than the slope of all the empirical data. And I would need to show an exhibit to illustrate that.
Okay. And what conclusion did you reach concerning impact to water quality?
Again, given such a small volumetric change, even at the lowest flow rates, under the recovery implementation program, we anticipate target flows on the order of 1,000, 1,300 CFS. I'm still less than 10%. I'm on the order of 5%. I'm not changing water quality. I'm just simply diverting 70 CFS. I'm not putting an additional load in. I'm not adding nutrients. It's just not going to have an impact.
Okay. And then what conclusion did you reach concerning recreational impacts to the river?
Again, the issues there were rafting, floating, fishing, etc. And based on my analysis, especially with the cross-section geometry collected downstream of the Green River gauge by USGS at 700 CFS, I had plenty of height to float a boat over. My changes in stage were so small that I wouldn't have any difficulty, even with formation of what we call point bars on the inside of bends. You still have the outside bow wedge or deepest part of the river the boat would go through. I did calculations based on the mean velocity changes and in a day's float time between having the flow in the river and taking 70 CFS. The worst case, at like the 98% exceedance low flow, was about 0.2 miles a day. I can make that up in 20 minutes of rowing downriver.
Okay. Let's talk about a few of the exhibits. If you turn to exhibit 14. Now, we had Mr. Olds look at a few of these, so I don't want to spend a lot of time. There are others we want to get to with you, but You have reviewed these hydrographs as well, correct?
Yes, sir.
And help us understand then, in terms of stream environment, how these illustrate the testimony that you've given us.
When I looked at the change in the flow duration curves as presented in Exhibit 14, one of the first things that came that became apparent to me in my analysis, independent of Mr. Olds, was that because of reoperation of Flaming Gorge and releasing water during the low flow period, we now have higher flows than what we would have had without Flaming Gorge. So we have more water during the low flow period on average, almost all of the time, and that is a benefit to the fisheries. There is some reduction in the peak flows, but with my assessment and opinion in the recovery implementation program, those target geomorphic flows of 8,000, 14,000, 24,000 over a range of water year types, the geomorphic processes will be maintained, so I'm not concerned with a 70 CFS reduction.
We've mentioned quite a few times the recovery implementation program, but I'm not sure we've really defined it for the court. Could you briefly describe what that is in connection with the endangered fish?
Mr. Rolls talked to it eloquently. It is a combination of the Bureau of Reclamation, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the various states and resources, Utah Division of Wildlife Resources, who are out monitoring the Upper Colorado River systems, in particular the Green, what's going on with the endangered species, what's happening with non-native interactions, how are the projected analysis of the recommended flow regime, again, the targets under low flow, average year, water year. That program is intended to inform the science behind the decision-making on a year-to-year basis of the status of the system and how to operate Flaming Gorge.
All right. Now, I think I may have interrupted you. Were you finished with Exhibit 14?
Yeah. Well, I'm not concerned. I just simply cannot fathom a concern at the high flow range because of how small 70 is relative to the magnitude of the flow. I think it's important to also note that a flow duration curve says, well, this flow is equal to or exceeded 10% of the time. What this doesn't tell you is that with an instantaneous reduction, you do not change the timing of these flows. I mean, when the flood comes, it comes at exactly the same time. It's simply reduced by 70 CFS.
And that's because the 70 CFS withdrawal is constant.
It's constant. So there is no change in the timing. There is no change, some small de minimis change. I'm sorry. There is no change in the frequency. Those floods will come at the same frequency, the 70 CFS, has absolutely no bearing on the frequency of the floods. It changes the magnitude by 70 CFS, less than 1%.
Okay. Now, Mr. Rolls talked about Exhibit 15. It is a sort of a chart numerical description of what Exhibit 14 tells us, correct?
Correct.
Now, let's just... I want to jump to turn to Exhibit 24. Do you have that?
Yes, sir.
Tell us what that is, please.
What I calculated here was that a reversion rate of 70 CFS is less than a 5% flow reduction. This is the low flow range, below 8,000 CFS. As I've indicated, above 8,000, I think you can just set off to the side because it's just inconsequential. So concentrating on the low range, what I did was look at the percent flow reduction. If I have 1,000 CFS in the river, 10% of that is 100 CFS. 70 is less than 10%. And these basically tell you then what kind of percent reduction. You'll notice that the 99 percentile, it is 10, it's because there was that one flow of, I think, 768 CFS, and why you, that one day we got the flow. It's right. Not like that flow was there day after day after day.
Right. Okay. And... turn to turn to exhibit, well, I think I want to go to 37 next. Turn to 37. Would you tell the court what that depicts, please?
Yes. I requested from the USGS that they actually had river geometry, physically measured geometry, in the vicinity of the Green River Gauge. And what you need to realize is that when we put a gauging station in at a given location, depending upon the river characteristics, the individual measuring the flow may move a little upstream or they may move a bit downstream to get the best conditions to measure the discharge, because they want an accurate discharge measurement. What I thought was interesting here is that looking at the morphology of the Green River, which is dominated by canyons, non-alluvial or channels that can adjust their width very much, but pockets of areas where you can get side channel or backwater formation. Well, if you go downriver a bit, and this is interesting because it corresponds kind of approximately where Mr. Norris's exhibit shows flows at two flow rates at the Green River Gauge and then downstream a bit with the formation of a sandbar at a lower discharge. What this is a basically a rectilinear channel showing the water surface at a flow rate of 1,340. And at that kind of a discharge, my change in stage, I'm going to say generously, is a half an inch. You can just look at this graph and see it's not going to change the width. It's not really going to change the depth. Pretty graphic. Mm-hmm. What's important then is the next figure is just downstream a bit. But now this is measured at...
Are you talking about 38?
I'm sorry, exhibit 38 okay. is measured at 980 CFS. This would be at the very low end of the variance of the target flow range in the recovery implementation program. Again, at this sort of flow rate from my regression, it's on the order of a half an inch. And what you see is it's not going to change the width. It's not going to change the depth. Then finally, in exhibit 39, this is very telling because the channel geometry has changed. I would expect things like this to happen. It's 709 CFS. This is at the very bottom end of the flows recorded at the gauge. And if you do then the calculation of the expected change in the stage, this is in the vicinity of the gauge where all the empirical data is collected, and you get a very small change in stage, you are not exposing the middle of the river. It's got a mid-channel bar. It's no longer a nice uniform U-shape. It's behaving the way I would expect the Sandbed River to behave.
And just so it's clear for the court, what you're talking about, the line in the graph, that depicts what the bottom of the river
That's
channel looks like.
That's the bottom of the river.
Okay.
So from a recreation point of view, if I'm coming down on what's on the figure here to the right-hand side, you know, I've still got 3 foot of depth, my fully loaded whitewater 14-foot momentum rafts drawing about 4.5 or 5 inches of water. You know, I'm going to float right by this section of the river.
Okay. Now, go back to Exhibit 25. We talked about regression equation and rating curves. Would you tell us what Exhibit 25 illustrates, please?
This figure represents the combined data from rating curve, I think 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, and 12 from the Green River Gauge. So all of the data pulled together that I fit, Y is A, in this case X is the discharge raised to an exponent or power, and R squared of 0.95. Now, what is important to realize here and why I went with the pooled data in particular, other than I wanted to know the variability. First of all, I'm not concerned about flows at 15,000 CFS and removing 70, so I didn't care about the fit there. What I was really concerned about was the fit on the lower range. Point number one I would like to make is if you draw a line on the bottom of the blue diamonds, mm-hmm. and then you compare my black line, which is the regression equation, it should be obvious that the slope of the blue dots is like this, but the slope of the regression is much steeper. Therefore, if I go, say, a Q of 2,500, which is halfway between the squares, and I go up to the bottom of the blue, I'm just going to say it's 6, And then I cut that in half and go to the bottom of the blue. I'm going to be halfway. I'm going to be at 5, basically.
Would you mind just standing up so that the judge can see exactly what you're drawing?
So I drew a line on the bottom of the blue, and I went to about 2,500, and where I intersect the line, I would be at 6. If I cut the flow by 2,500 cubic feet per second, I would come over and be at about 5, so I would reduce the stage by a foot. If I look at the black line, it's much steeper, and if I do those same flows, I'm going to go between about a 6.4 down to about 5, so I am overestimating the change in the depth given that 2,500 CFS change in discharge. Well, clearly, even whether you use the blue line or the regression, changing the flow by 70 winds up in small changes in stage.
Okay. Now, turn to Exhibit 26.
What this figure demonstrates is I calculated the change in stage after removal of 70 CFS on a daily basis for the same period of record.
Mm-hmm.
And it's basically the same as the flow duration curve. What this says is for a given discharge, how much of a change in stage would there be? And as you can see at the very low range, it's 0.12 feet. Well, 12 times 12 is 144, so that's 1.4 inches would be probably the maximum expected change of stage at the gauge.
After taking 70 CFS out.
After taking 70 CFS out.
Okay. And I think Exhibit 27 is a reflection of 26.
Yes, sir, it is.
All right. Just, we don't need to go through every one. Pick one. Any of those exceedance levels, and then walk through the column and just explain so the court understands what this means.
I'll use the 95% exceedance. So that's a discharge of 1,420. If I take, and the stage computed there would be 5.43 feet. If I take 70 CFS out, I get 1,350 CFS. Again, this is in the ballpark of the recommended flows for the recovery implementation program. Well, the change in stage at the gauge is 5.36 feet. That difference is 0.068 feet. 0.068 times 12 inches, very, very small.
Okay. And in terms, when you talk about stage, you're talking about depth.
Depth.
Okay. Quickly, Exhibit 28.
This is the second continuity equation. Velocity is a power law of the discharge. In this case, X would be the discharge. This is a fit to, again, I pool all of the data to be consistent with the stage. This was the equation I used then to say if I remove 70 CFS on a daily basis, what would my change in mean column velocity be?
Okay. And 29?
29 is basically after you remove 70 CFS and you compute the change in mean column velocity, this is how much that velocity would change as you have increases in discharge. And as you can see, once you get above 8,000, 10,000 CFS, the relative change in velocity, because you're removing so little, is basically nothing.
Right. And then Exhibit 30 is, again, a numerical reflection of 29.
Correct. And again, at the 95% exceedance, going from 1420, my mean channel velocity is about 1.19 feet per second. You remove 70, the discharge is now 1350. My mean column velocity is 1.16 feet per second. So you've reduced it by on the order of 0.04 feet per second.
Okay. And then look at Exhibit 31.
31 is the power law continuity equation with width is the function of the discharge. And this is very classic for almost all river systems where the variability in width is a lot higher. That concerned me initially until I kept looking at all my data from Google Earth and the channel and how confined the channel is by Bedrock Canyon. And therefore, you're really not going to get huge changes. And that's why so much of the data, Your Honor, is vertical. It's just because it's going up and down, not so much being changed because it has no place to change the width in reality.
Okay.
So that's to be expected. So that was the equation I used to then estimate changes in width with changes in discharge. And that's reflected in Exhibit 32. As you decrease discharges after removing 70 CFS, these are the sort of width changes you would expect to see at the gauge.
And how would you characterize those width changes?
Very small. They're feet. Some places in the river are going to be a bit more, some places in the river a bit less. But this is what is happening at the gauge.
Okay. And then, again, 33 is a numerical depiction of 32.
Correct. 95% exceedance level. If you look at the change of 70 CFS, it's on the order of a foot or less.
Okay. And that's at the 95.
Yes, sir. And it's reflected, I think it's important to note, with the cross-section geometries we showed at the 1,000, the 900, and the 760 empirically measured a mile down from the gauge location, those cross-sections show the same answer based on the regression equation at the gauge a mile upstream. And that's important because it works.
Okay. Then the last three, 34, 35, and 36.
Cross-section in 34, I wanted to look at the change in cross-sectional area. Those plots I showed a mile downstream at 1,980 and 706. I wanted to see what happened with cross-sectional area. The reason I did that is I wanted to see what the potential implications were to basically wetted perimeter, the area upon the bed which produces, macroinvertebrates.
Let me stop you and ask you, when you talk about cross-section area, what does that mean when you're just looking at the river?
If I look at Exhibit 37, I am looking into the river. The area between the water surface and the bed, if you counted up all those little squares in their area, that would be the cross-sectional area. Okay. So it's the area between the water surface and the bed of the river.
Okay.
So it's a pretty good index of the conveyance of water through the cross-section.
It's like taking a slice out of the river.
And looking
and
at
examining
it. In it. Right.
Okay. Gotcha.
So that's the cross-sectional area changes. Again, it was informative to me. Exhibit 35 shows that in square feet, that the largest changes over the range of all the daily discharges removing 70, on order of 35 square feet. But the bulk of the differences is on the order of 5 to 7 to 8 square feet over almost the full range of normal discharges.
Okay.
And then 36 is simply the equivalent tabular data for the graphs, 95% exceedance value removing 70, we're changing the cross-sectional area by about 24 square feet.
All right. And then the last exhibit, you pretty much covered it, but this is the recreation impacts where you calculated the effect on floating or rafting the river.
Well, it was more than just recreational impacts. It is the vast majority of the river channel in the 120 miles of the Green River is confined canyon. And indicative of this sort of geometry. And if you look at all the Google Earth imagery between flow rates, exhibit number 39 shows up in the imagery with formation of mid-channel bars. That's just an artifact of sediment transport and dynamics. So this to me was very telling that I'm getting the dynamics of most of the river captured in the empirical data at the gauge, and empirical data collected a mile downstream from the river.
All right, and pick one of the exceedance categories to explain the effect of the 70 CFS discharge, or of diversion.
All right, I am going to go to exhibit 28 or 27. This is a change in depth with a 70 CFS diversion. Let's go to the 99% exceedance value, which is 700, and if Your Honor would let me say 709 is about the same as 700, I'm going to get a 0.12 foot change in stage. 0.12 times 12, 144, 1.4 inches, right? And so if you take the blue line on page 39 and you look at that sort of change, it's like the second line down on the graph. It's very, in my testimony, de minimis.
All right. All right, then. Then based on the analysis you provided, what is your opinion as to whether the applications, if approved, would have an unreasonable effect on the natural stream environment at Green River?
In my professional opinion, from experience in modeling and looking at the changes, reviewing the available biological data on backwater use and backwater areas and depths, my testimony is that the proposed diversion of 70 CFS would be de minimis and not result in impacts to recreation, fisheries, water quality, etc.
All right. No further questions, Your Honor.
I think what we'll do is, if it's all right, we'll take a short 10-minute break before we begin cross-examination.
That'd be great.
So everybody will be back here on the record at 3 o'clock. Thank you.
All rise. All rise. 7th District Court now reconvening. The Honorable Mark Harmon, Jr. presiding.
Please be seated, ladies and gentlemen. We'll be back on the record in case 1207009, Emory County case, Heal Utah et al. Versus Kane County Water Conservancy District et al. Rick Show Council is present. Dr. Hardy's on the stand.
Your Honor, I had said I was finished with Dr. Hardy, but actually I was wrong. I kind of skipped around in my notes and forgot to ask a couple of questions. I just need to finish that. Dr. Hardy, we didn't talk about the issue of non-native fish and the impact of the introduction of non-native fish in the Green River on the native fish, and particularly the endangered species. How has that informed your opinion as to whether the withdrawal of 70 CFS endangers or further endangers those fish?
I'm really concerned about the presence of non-native fish in the Green River. If you look at the available data on collecting fish in backwaters year after year after year, they are dominated by the presence of non-native competitors and predators. In my humble opinion, it may be more of an issue towards long-term recovery of the species than the type of flow alterations we're talking about. Not to suggest in my testimony that flow alteration, presence of dams have not had an impact on the native fish, but as it stands today, the presence of non-natives is a huge, huge concern.
The non-native fish compete for food?
Food, space, and direct predation. Remember that the age zero, for example, Colorado pike minnow are very small fish, and they're drifting. When they get into the backwater and you've got a red shiner, for example, will predate. I know in the Virgin River, I found three red shiners in 1984. By 1988, they had completely taken over the fish community, and we had the rope known the river in an attempt to get rid of red shiner in an attempt to save the native fish. I mean, this is non-natives are a serious problem in the basin.
That's it, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wright. Mr. Clinton?
Ms. Clinton? Yes.
Mr. Hardy?
Hi.
Oops. Can you hear me all right? Can you hear me all right?
Yeah, that's better.
Okay. You talked a lot about your background. Do you consider yourself to be an expert on any of the endangered species present in the Colorado River?
I don't know if I would say I was an expert, but I would say I was an expert on native fishes in general.
You mentioned in your work years ago with BioWest, I believe, that as part of it you worked with species experts to determine habitat issues and suitability, correct?
My testimony is I worked at BioWest and a team that helped with species experts to develop habitat suitability criteria for the endangered species.
Thank you for the clarification. But I suppose my question is, are you distinguishing between yourself and species experts, as you explained?
We brought in people like Carol Titus, Chuck Makeda, and others who had sampled on the river. Ron Weil and I took, at the time, all the available monitoring data and analyzed the depth and velocities of use by the various endangered species. At the time, I was on the Virgin River Fishes Recovery Team and had been sampling similar species like the round-tailed chub, bony-tailed chub in the Green River. I had been working on native fishes, and so our job was to analyze the available biological data to say this is what we think the preferences or requirements for things like depth, velocity, habitat use, et cetera, were. And then we ran a workshop where we had the experts in the room discussing those results and coming up with final versions of the curves for depth, for velocity, for substrate, for each of the endangered species.
Okay. And in your analysis, you always assumed a 70 CFS diversion, right?
I'm sorry, just one more time.
A 70 CFS diversion. That's what you assumed in
an instantaneous diversion of 70 CFS.
At a constant rate over time.
Yes.
Okay. And you do not know whether there are any contaminants in the affected area of the river, correct?
Not to my knowledge.
And you did not consider whether there would be any increased concentration of contaminants in the water from the proposed depletions because, as you testified, it's purely a withdrawal. Nothing will return to the river, correct?
Two aspects of that, yes. My testimony is if you're withdrawing water, there is no release back. So you're not increasing the concentration just by removing the 70 CFS. In my general consideration of changes in potential water quality, I just could not envision any water quality constituent at the sort of magnitudes of the base flow versus the reduction that would result in changes that would be of concern to me.
Just so we've got that clear, what we're essentially saying is if I've got a tablespoon of salt mixed into a gallon of water and I pour out a cup, the concentration, assuming it's well mixed and everything, should still be the same in both the cup and
yes,
what's left of the gallon, right?
Because the milligrams per liter remains the same because you've just simply taken out a volume of the water.
Correct. And that's essentially what you're saying with your analysis of when you're only removing 70 CFS from the river and none of it is being returned, that the concentration in the river, in the Green River, should be essentially unchanged.
Correct. Within, yes, correct.
Okay. You've testified that the USGS gauge station at Green River is in a roughly U-shaped channel, correct?
I don't believe I said that the USGS gauge at the Green River was in a U-shaped channel. I indicated in my exhibits collected approximately a mile downriver that at the 1,000 and the 980 it was a U-shaped channel, but was not that at the 709.
Do you recall giving a deposition in this case?
Correct.
And you recall that you were under oath at that time?
Yes.
And I was actually the person there questioning you, correct?
Correct.
So, do you recall when I asked you, so the USGS gauge station at Green River is in a steep U-shaped channel, right? Your answer, yes, approximately a U-shaped channel, period. Are you now changing that answer?
No, because I think it's clear in my exhibits that at two of the measured discharges, the 1,000 and the 908, it's approximately a U-shape, but then at the 709, it is no longer an approximate U-shape.
Let's talk about that 709 location, because my understanding is that was Exhibit 39, I should say Defense Exhibit 39, and that my understanding from your work, Professor Hardy, is that this separate location, that you only had one day's worth of data from this location. Is that accurate?
Yes, this is a measurement of the cross-section geometry approximately 0.75 miles downstream of the gauge collected by USGS.
Correct. And is it your position today that that point of measurement represents significantly different river morphology than represented at the gauge?
No, it's indicative of the variability that would be expected at the gauge.
Thank you. At the gauge. It's not intended to be representative of changes in the river further downstream, for example.
No, it would be also indicative of changes. This is a sand bed river. Sand bed rivers have changes in morphology And as I indicated previously in my testimony, if you look at the changes in river morphology, middle bars versus side bars over the full range of flows available in Google Earth, you can see these sort of mid-channel features coming and going depending upon the date of the imagery and the flow rate.
Let me clarify. Your position is still, as I believe you testified in deposition, that the location, the point of measurement, let's call it, captured in Exhibit 39, that is representative of, you view it's consistent with the morphology at the exact gauge. Is that correct?
I'm sorry.
Let me rephrase.
Just a little, I have my hearing aids in, but I'm having a little bit of trouble hearing you now. Listen a little louder.
No, please. What I'm trying to get at is the July 23rd, let's call it point of measurement, reflected in Exhibit 39. Well, with me so far?
Yes.
Okay. I understand you saying that it is representative of the type of changes that could occur at the gauge point as well, correct?
Yes.
And your position is that the gauge, and I'm referring to the Green River gauge that we've referred to, is representative of downstream reaches of the Green River to the confluence with the Colorado. Is that accurate?
It is representative of many sections of the Green River between the Green River gauge and the confluence with the Colorado.
Thank you for that clarification. And then all I'm trying to pin down is with that July 23rd isolated point that we have, is it your position today that that is an additional point of reference that in addition to the Green River gauge morphology would show you what other downstream morphology might react, how it might react to the proposed diversion?
It is in fact a measurement of the Green River approximately 0.7 miles downstream of the Green River gauge and therefore indicative of the channel conditions at that physical location in the Green River.
In fact, you believe that the gauging station at Green River is probably more sensitive to the changes in flow because it is less confined than downstream reaches. Is that correct?
It would be more sensitive to changes in flow compared to steep, confined bedrock sections of the channel in the lower Green River, and may be less sensitive to flow than some other sections that might have wider, more alluvial channels, sections, which occur in small areas within the Green River, below the Green River gauge.
Right. You don't deny that there are alluvial sections of the Green River downstream from the gauge, correct?
Yes, there are.
And I think you also testified that, did you attempt to quantify the extent of backwater or alluvial sections of the river downstream?
I did this in two ways. I went to the original work by Mike Pucciarelli in 1988 and then his summary published in 2000, I believe, for the 1989 data that calculated for the Green River gauge down the 120 miles of river in 20-mile segments and showed that the number of backwaters was approximately 0.8 to 1.2 to 1.4 per mile. On average in 1988, it was about one backwater per mile. They also calculated a number of side channels, and there was about 0.2 side channels per mile on average over the 120 miles. I also then took Google Earth and I looked at the river, and for example, September 26, 2004, I believe, approximately 1,700 cubic feet per second. I took the liberty of measuring what I considered to be side channels or potential back waters down the channel for the 120 miles, came up with about 6% of the linear distance of being backwaters on those images for that date.
And taking those numbers, either the ones from the historical data that you referenced from the publication or from your, let's call it your Google Earth analysis for shorthand, those numbers are about the frequency with which that type of habitat occurred, correct?
Correct.
They don't say anything about the importance or significance of that habitat, correct?
Correct.
On your Google Earth analysis, what dates were available for all stretches of the river? I've dealt with Google Earth before. I know that some areas might have certain dates that are available, and then the next one over has different dates. Did you track that?
I did, but I don't specifically recall that. I know that I tried to stay with the same date, but as I looked at imagery, and what I indicated is I would take a section of the river, and I would use all of the dates, and I would look at what was there, and if I had the, if imagery wasn't available on the same date, I tried to, pick the closest date with the flow rate that was there to try to take variation out of the analysis. I just wanted to know, on a linear distance, how much of the river channel would be these type of features.
So, but did you then, I haven't seen anywhere disclosed, like, the actual dates that you were trying to create windows of?
As I indicated, I believe it was September 26th of 2004 was the date of the, most of the imagery that I used to do the my assessment of what I thought backwaters or side channels were.
Just that date?
No, I indicated in my testimony that I looked at all the dates, but when I did my measurements, it was approximately that date. Unless there wasn't imagery available on that date in a section of river, then I tried to pick a date that had approximately the same flow rate.
Just so we're clear, we're saying that when you're doing your, when you say measurements, you're talking about the measurements of the frequency of the backwater habitats occurring in that stretch, or are you talking about a different frequency?
The length, I tried to measure the length of what I thought was the backwater to compare it to the total length of the river.
As measured on or about September?
In the 2004 period, right.
Okay. And you, my question then is, did you compare the existence of the backwaters, you call it by frequency or by distance, to another date and time for the entire length of the river?
No, just generally the... fundamentally for the information collected by Pucciarelli in 1988 and 1989.
Okay.
I'm sorry. I also read the study that involved Utah Division of Wildlife Resources and Steve Meisner, where they looked at non-native removal techniques in backwaters, and they did have the frequency and number based, but they had a protocol that did not do complete enumeration, and so I didn't try to compare it to that because they started at a random place and only sampled the first two backwaters and didn't really enumerate all of them, so it was a bit of apple and oranges.
Okay. So with respect to the flow data, you used flow data from the USGS Green River Gauge, correct?
Correct.
And you only used flow data from that gauge, correct?
Correct.
You're aware that there are additional gauges near that section of river?
Generally, but not specifically.
Are you aware that there are additional gauges between Green River Gauging Station and the confluence with the Colorado?
Generally, but not specifically.
Did you make any attempt to gather data from any of those gauges?
No.
You've testified that most, and if you want to qualify most, please be my guest, but most of the sections of the downstream, of the Green River downstream from the proposed diversion are in a confined hard rock channel. Is that accurate?
Generally speaking, yes. I mean, it's dominated by that kind of bed form.
And the exceptions might come into play with the backwater habitats that we were discussing earlier, correct?
Correct. Pucciarelli's data indicated in 1988 there was 116 backwaters. And in 1989, I think there was like 206 backwaters that were delineated between, basically in Reach 3 of the Green River.
Okay. And those backwaters would react differently to changes in flow than the section where you took the measurements of the Green River Gauge, correct?
Yes, they would.
And did you attempt to model the effects on the backwater habitat specifically?
Yes, to the extent that I looked at the changes in stage, and this is where, from an analytical geomorphic perspective, the continuity equations. Stage versus discharge, width versus discharge, velocity versus discharge, geometry attestation. Gauges are typically put in on runs where you have nice straight laminar flow characteristics. Ripples have higher gradient, pools have less gradient, and so typically if you compare the exponent to the discharge, which is the slope of the water surface line, it is steeper in ripples and less so in backwaters, and so using data from the run is more like the reach average, but it's going to be less in a pool or backwater, so you're overestimating, you're underestimating ripples. There are not very many ripples in the lower section of the Green River below the Green River gauge. That knowledge led me to believe that I had a good idea of the magnitude of the change. The second part is that it's not so much that there is an instantaneous change in stage. It's continuous, and so the formation of the backwater is occurring during the higher flow period of the year, and so you are still going to get small, medium, and large depths for backwaters in the river. It's not that you are taking the backwater and instantaneously dropping it by that stage, so it's overestimating the impact.
No, I understand that, but when you're looking at the calculations, let's say the exceedance levels for the changes in stage, those are calculated at the location of the Green River gauge, correct?
Correct.
And your calculations in change of width of the river based on the proposed withdrawal were based on the data from the Green River gauge, not further downstream, correct?
Correct, except for the three exhibits that were collected at approximately 0.75 to a mile downstream of the gauge.
But again, you view those as typical of the river morphology near where the gauge is, not necessarily different areas downstream, correct?
It was still a more alluvial section than the section of the gauge, and not dissimilar to the section in Mr. Norris's testimony that he pointed out downstream of the gauge.
And again, that's more alluvial section you're referring to. That's the July 23rd point of measurement, correct?
Correct.
For which you have only one day's worth of data, correct?
Correct.
Okay. You did not forecast projected flows in 2014 or 2020 or any other year, correct?
No.
You analyzed the impact of the proposed diversion using historical flows and historical average flows, correct?
Correct.
You did not incorporate any forecasts of future flows from third parties, such as the Bureau of Reclamation's 2012 study, correct?
Not in the analysis that was conducted, but I did examine those material as when they came out and in preparation of this hearing today.
And do you have additional analysis to disclose to us at this time using that?
No, just generally didn't change my opinion.
Okay. Your opinion as to the impact of the diversion would not change if the frequency or the duration of the low flow periods increased in the future, right?
My testimony was that over the range of discharges that are expected at the gauge, that the 70 CFS diversion would not represent a negative impact.
So I'm trying to get at, we're talking about, you're basing it on the historical flows rather than doing some projection of or forecast of future flows, right? And you agree with that?
I'll answer it this way. Back in 1995, I was part of a team that looked at severe sustained drought in the upper Colorado River Basin. My job in that was to model the expected changes or implications on the endangered species. As part of that exercise, tree ring reconstruction was evaluated going back from 700 AD to the present. And there were extensive, long periods of severe sustained drought in the 1200s to 1500s, where the flows at Lee Ferry were estimated to be on the order of 10 million acre feet, way less than what we see now. That's important from two perspectives, frankly, in my formulating an opinion. First and foremost, those long periods of severe sustained drought at a fraction of the flows we see, at the time we measured fish, we had these fish in the river, so they were able to make it through those severe sustained droughts and be present in the river. Number two, we were very low flows, and at the time we got high enough, when we started measuring flows, we had the Colorado Compact. Fundamentally, like Mr. Old said, we have gone through periods of very low flow, followed by high flow, followed by low flow, followed by high flow. We have the record of data we have now, and the trend analysis, as Mr. Old says, reflects in large measure the depletions due to the development of water in the basin, and we do not know what the future will bring. It's just as much that the flows could go into a wetter cycle again as it is that they could continue into a drier cycle. So that did have a bearing on my evaluation and testimony.
So I think what you just answered, which I'm not certain, we may have to go back to the original question, but so I understand what you just testified. You said, one, that basically fish survive droughts, and two, that we don't know what the future brings as far as trying to project trends forward into the future for various reasons.
Correct.
Accurate. So, back to my original question. Your opinion as to the impact of this diversion would not change if you were presented with data that showed the frequency or the duration of low flow periods increased in the future. Is that right?
I would want to see what the frequency and the duration and magnitude of those low flows were before I would render an opinion.
Professor Hardy, do you recall in deposition when we talked about this same issue? And I asked, just to keep the hypothetical simple, let's say that the dry periods themselves were not significantly more severe, but they were more frequent than in the past 30 years. Would that affect your opinion? Your answer was, my initial reaction is if the volumes are on the same order of what I had evaluated, my opinion would not change because those volumes and the 70 CFS reduction do not have an impact, whether they last for 3 weeks or 3 months, or once every 5 years or twice every 5 years, those impacts are not a problem in this sort of hypothetical situation. Do you agree with that answer, to, as you
yes,
said?
Yes, I do, because okay. You parameterize the hypothetical where your question was open-ended without any context.
But to be clear, you added the parameters of the frequency and duration. But within what you added, you would maintain that answer?
Yes.
Okay. You testified today and at the administrative hearing previously that in sum, and I'm trying to include depth, width, temperature, velocity, the various factors that you've analyzed, that the proposed diversion would represent a de minimis change to the natural stream environment, correct?
Yes.
Are you aware that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Services has defined what constitutes a de minimis withdrawal in the Upper Colorado River Basin?
Not to my knowledge.
You didn't incorporate that definition in your analysis when you said it was de minimis, did you?
No.
And if you learned that the Fish and Wildlife Service defined de minimis withdrawal in the Upper Colorado River Basin as less than 0.1 acre foot per year, that wouldn't change your analysis?
No.
But the proposed diversion under the change application significantly exceeds that amount, doesn't it?
Yes.
Let's talk about the width analysis that you did, the changes in width of the river. You've testified that the potential change in river width of up to, I believe this was going to the 99% exceedance level, 1.3 feet, would be a de minimis change in river width, correct?
Correct.
And your claim that it is de minimis is based on the change relative to the overall width of the river at that point, correct?
Correct.
So when we say at that point, we're talking about at the point of the Green River gauge where you're taking data, correct?
Yes, and in combination with looking at the Google Earth imagery over a range of flows, which range, I think, from 8 and 12,000 down to 1,200, and if you go to section after section in the canyon reaches and you look at the difference in the width and you measure between the 8,000 imagery or the 12,000 imagery and 1,250 or 1,270, you just do not get large changes in the width relative to the total width of the river.
So my question is not aimed at undermining the calculation of up to 1.3 feet, which I understand you're saying would, although I may not agree, I understand you're saying that that would apply on down the river. If anything, it might be on the high end, correct?
It's just indicative of what you would expect in confined reaches. Yes.
So my question, though, has to do with assuming that that's the right change in width, 1.3 feet, all right? that your claim that that is just a de minimis change has to take into account where whatever the total width of the river at that point is, correct?
Correct. Because I looked at the river.
So did you do width measurements of the river all the way down to the confluence with the Colorado?
Yes, I did.
And what is the average width?
I want to say something on the order of maybe 350 feet, something like that.
Mm-hmm. That's the average for the entire, from the point of diversion, or at least from the Green River gauge down to the confluence with the Colorado River.
So that my testimony is clear. I started at the gauge, and I would bring the imagery up, mm-hmm. and I would look at the channel. If all the channel was the same, I would take a width measurement. I would scroll down and go, oh, here's an entire section, quarter mile, half mile, and it's all in a canyon. This is approximately what it looks like. I would take a width measurement.
For whatever Google Earth had available in September 2006?
All of the available imagery. When I was doing that, I was looking at what was the highest flow, what was the lowest flow, what was happening in the channel. And in those sections where you have confined canyons, you just don't see a change in the width because it only goes up and down. It doesn't have alluvial features.
And where you have the more alluvial sections, you would see more, or you'd expect to see more of an impact.
And they do have greater variability in the alluvial section, mineral bottoms.
Mm-hmm. And that could be greater than 1.3 feet in those sections.
Yes, it may be on the order, it could be 10, 15, or 20 feet, 30 feet even, but that's relative to 300 or 400 feet of width in the channel.
But again, we're talking about coming in from the sides, I assume, this is how it narrows. So you're talking about, what you just said, 10, 20, 30 feet narrower.
Out of 300 or 400 feet, yes.
Mm-hmm. You didn't assume any particular type of intake structure in your analysis, right?
I'm sorry, I didn't quite catch all of that.
Sorry, I tend to speak up quickly. You did not assume any particular type of intake structure in your analysis,
right? That is correct. In my previous testimony, I indicated that that would be addressed as part of the NEPA an EIS process.
That was beyond the scope of what you were asked to look at, correct?
Correct.
And you were not aware of Blue Castle asking anyone else for advice regarding the design of an intake structure at this time, correct?
Not to my knowledge, other than I did have some discussions with them relative to my work on senior design of the fish passage structure at the Washington Fields Diversion in the Virgin River, and that one of the things they might consider in their diversion was things like mitigation, where on balance you might get 8 to 10% of a return flow in order to capture fish to return them to the river, that they could then mitigate by creating an artificial side channel for rearing of the endangered species, only to that extent, but nothing in terms of actual design of the structure.
So this mitigation, suggestion that you made, were you evaluating it specifically with respect to, say, the Colorado pike minnow?
Yes, or razorback sucker or any other larval drifting fish.
That are found there in that stretch of the Colorado River?
Correct.
And it's your opinion that you could resolve these issues by explaining to me the design criteria that you suggested?
Well, I mean, from working with the Bureau of Reclamation's fish screening shop with the two senior design teams that we put together at Utah State and the Civil and Environmental Engineering Department, we provided preliminary designs for the fish structure on the Washington Fields diversion, which used a rotary drum fish screen, which you divert water into the canal, it goes through the screen, and it pulls off the fry or the juveniles, and they are returned to the river with the bypass flow. There are a number of design options that you can do that include minimization of attractant flows in the forebay where you move fish to one side but then you pull water where they're less likely to be entrained, and then you can have fish screening. So with Blue Castle, it was just from that experience suggesting that there might be ways to help minimize the potential entrainment of any larval fishes coming down the river.
But to your understanding, no decision has been made on the type of intake or diversion.
I have no knowledge of that.
Okay. And that's not part of your conclusion as to de minimis impact?
Correct.
Okay. your testimony today, you made reference to the Colorado pike minnow, among others, but is probably being a fish of major concern, correct?
Correct.
And you referenced a study that had a large bearing on your analysis because it showed that, and please correct me if I misstate this, because this was the first, I think, that I became familiar with it, where 1 foot of a change in the stage, and it may have been worded as depth, was necessary to show a change, an increase in the size of the Colorado pike minnow. Is that accurate?
That doesn't.
To explain to me what that you indicated that one, it had a large bearing on your analysis to see that it took a foot difference in water to make an impact on the size of the Colorado pike minnow.
No, that's mischaracterization.
Please clarify.
The study by Haynes and Tyus in 1990 looked at the distribution of Colorado pike minnow as a function of mean maximum depth of backwaters.
The maximum depth?
Of backwaters. Okay. They broke it up into sizes of backwaters, less than 15 centimeters, 15 to 45 centimeters, 45 to 75, and greater than 75. So that's the max depth of the backwaters. What their data clearly shows is as you increase the average max depth of a backwater, the number of Colorado pike minnow you find increases.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the average maximum average of all of the measured backwaters was about 29 centimeters, 29.6. That's about a foot of water. If you remove an inch of water, you still have 11 inches of water in the backwater. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Another study that was done by Tyus and Haynes in 91 indicated that Colorado pike minnow, in their words, mainly used backwaters on the order of 38 centimeters, which is well over a foot of water. And so when I saw that the deeper the water, the more you have, okay, that's in the low flow period. A third element of that was studies conducted by Kishna and Hines. In 2004, but it was in the ORAE section, which is above this reach 3. But what they found there for winter survival and impacts was that during the fall, as temperatures decrease, Colorado pike minnow were moving from shallower to the deepest backwaters that were available. And over the period of their study, when Flaming Gorge was still hydropeaking and the flows would range between 600 and 900 CFS, so the change in flow is 300 CFS. In the upper end of the ORAE reach, they saw changes in stage measured in their backwater of 0.1 meters, but at the lower end of that section, it was 0.01 meters, which the lower end of the section is more indicative of the gradient of reach 3. And again, that is just evidence that the change in stage with a 300 CFS change in discharge, 0.01 meters, that's 0.3 inches. To me, that was just evidence of behavior of backwaters. At 300 CFS change in flow, I'm changing by 70. Physics tell me it has to be less.
You had calculated at the low flow measurement that you had approximately 700 CFS, about a 1.44 inches change in depth, correct?
Approximately, yes.
So that's the change in depth that we'd be considering for these backwaters with, I think you said, with the low, the average maximum depth of 29 centimeters, correct?
The average maximum depth reported in this that they reported was 29.6 centimeters.
Centimeters. Thank you. I misspoke completely on that. But was there anything in that that indicated that, I mean, I hear your testimony is that as the water got deeper and deeper, there were more Colorado pike minnow present in
Correct.
The study. Was there anything indicating the converse, that when you decreased existing backwaters, that it hurt or didn't hurt the Colorado pike minnow presence there?
No. The thing that that's critical to understand is with the continuous withdrawal of 70 CFS from a geomorphic perspective, backwaters are going to be created with features that will range from shallow to deep even with the 70 CFS reduction. So you're not instantaneously changing it, so you're still going to have a distribution of shallow to intermediate to deeper. What the data shows from the monitoring is that the Colorado pike minnow are going to preferentially continually selecting deeper backwaters for their use.
At every stage of their life?
Stage zero, going into the late summer, early fall, they will typically stay there over winter. That's why I thought the study at Oray was important, because it showed that they moved out of the shallower backwater into the deepest backwater to overwinter, and then they would leave those when they got into the spring to disperse.
Okay.
And I think the magic number there, if I recall correctly, is about 200 millimeters total length is when they started moving out and
of the fish
using side channels or margins of the stream.
It's your position that any potential impact on side channel habitats is mitigated by the fact that the fish are more mature by the time they move through those sections of the river. Is that correct?
The fish are growing as they move down into the lower Green River, where they will use these ephemeral backwater and side channels as rearing habitat. Even though there are very, very few side channels in the lower Green River. The studies by Cucciarelli in 1988-1989, on the order of 0.2 side channels per mile.
And again, that doesn't say anything as to the importance of the side channels, just the total area that they cover, correct?
Correct.
And it's your position that the majority of the rearing of these fish, specifically with the Colorado pike minnow, occurs upstream of the point of diversion. Is that accurate?
No. The fish migrate above the point of diversion during the spawning run into the Oray and Jensen Reach, where they spawn. After the fish hatch, they begin to move downriver, and the majority of the rearing actually occurs in the lower Green River in the lower section.
Downstream of the point of diversion.
Correct.
And that's specific to the Colorado pike minnow, your answer that you just gave, correct?
Correct.
Essentially, given that you were calculating relatively small changes in flow according to your data, you didn't identify any particular habitat type that would be unduly affected by the diversion, correct?
Again, as I indicated previously, if you look at the continuity equations on changes in depth, which is stage, changes in velocity, or changes in width, and you're using data from a run, which is typically where you gauge, that is probably very
indicative. And it's where this gauge is, correct?
I'm sorry?
I just want to clarify, typically where the gauge is, and in this case, it's where the gauge is located,
right,
correct?
Right,
in a run.
Right.
Okay. Please continue.
And that typically is more of the indicative of average conditions in the reach, where those equations show more sensitivity in riffles, a bit less in pools. And you want to look at that carefully. Look at the Jowett study for the 100 rivers in New Zealand, and you can confirm that.
Similarly, given the relatively small changes in flow that you anticipate, you didn't focus on whether young fish would be at a higher predation risk after the proposed diversion, did you?
No.
You admit that the measured low flow in your data, the 700 CFS, was well below the recommended mean base flow of 1,300 CFS in a dry year, correct?
Yes.
But
I'd also add that that is a measurement that occurred prior to the record of decision with the recovery implementation program.
Mm.
And you would not expect to see that flow because they are going to target 1,300 CFS.
Have you observed, you said that you collected the data, all that was available through 2012 from the USGS station? I know that you
I went to the USGS gauge water for this nation and asked it to download the available field data that they had posted on the site, and it went from 2007. I think October 23rd or something like that, 1979 through 2012.
Were there any instances in there where it went below 1,300 CFS?
Yes.
After the record of decision?
Mm.
You just stated that that was 2007 through 2012, I believe. And
yes, I think it was in 2004. Was the 700? I have to go back and check. I don't remember specifically. What I do remember, though, is that the number of times that flows are that low are on the order of 95%, 98%, 99% exceedance.
No, I'm asking you about the frequency. I understand the exceedance tables that you've drafted. But with respect to that, you would not expect to see any flows below 1,300 CFS after the record of decision. Is that borne out by your review of the data?
Mm-hmm. In part, yes, and in part, no. I think the thing to remember about the flows are targets. And as specified in the record of decision and the reoperation of Flaming Gorge, there's up to a 25%, I think, variation in those that they are anticipating to be built in without harm to the species, because those are the recommended flows. So if they're willing to look at 1,300 with a 25% variation, then I would not be surprised if we had flows less than 1,300 on occasion. Would they sustain them? I don't believe so.
Okay. You stated today that we're in discussing the de minimis finding that we're not at risk of more than 10% change in flows, correct?
No, my testimony is that in the we don't see more than we do not observe a more than a 10% reduction in flows over the range of anticipated flows.
On Exhibit 24, Defendant's Exhibit 24. I think you were here in the courtroom earlier today, correct?
Yes.
Did you hear Mr. Olds give his testimony?
Yes.
Sorry, I moved away from the mic. He testified that there would be approximately a 10% impact on flows at the 2002 low flow point of 700 CFS that we discussed, right?
Correct.
And you agree with that, in fact, right?
Yes.
At that data point.
If that single daily flow of 700 were to see a 70 CFS reduction, then you would have a 10% reduction.
That would be 10%. And that's consistent with an Exhibit 24. In your 95 to 99% exceedance range, we've got 4.9 to 10.1% reduction in flow, correct?
Because the 10.1 reflects the single data value.
I understand. But so essentially, 5% of the time, you could expect to see a roughly 5 to 10% impact on the flow, correct?
No. In the 95 to 99% interval, you would expect to see a 5 to 10%.
Thank you.
Noting that the 10.1% is a single daily value.
Correct. The only data that you had from that particular location, in fact, right?
Correct.
And so, you referenced just now a 25% built-in variation in the flows that's anticipated by the record of decision or the operating plan for Flaming Gorge?
Correct. That's the way I've read it.
So, would it be your position then that anything less than 25% impact on flows is de minimis?
I think it would depend upon the nature of what more than 25% look like for how long. If it was a single day, probably not.
Mm.
It went for 6 years, probably.
So the duration and frequency of the low flows would matter?
Yes.
Okay. And you acknowledge that some of the downstream sections, downstream from the proposed point of diversion of the Green, are part of the critical habitat for the four endangered fish species in the lower Green, right?
Yes.
But you didn't specifically take the critical habitat designation into consideration because you don't think that it mattered to your analysis, correct?
I think I took the critical habitat into consideration because it was part of my evaluation of whether there was impacts or not.
Okay. recall in your deposition when I asked you, did you consider whether any of the Green River downstream proposed project has been designated a critical habitat for any species? Your response was, I did not specifically take that in as special consideration because I just didn't think it wasn't an impact in my mind and it didn't matter whether it was critical habitat designated or not. I looked at it, I want to give the complete answer. I looked at it from the perspective of these fish use these river corridor, what are the impacts? Whether it was a legal designation was not a factor in my opinion.
Right.
Is that consistent with your testimony here today?
Yes, because I think that the key is I'm recognizing the importance of backwater habitat, that those are the nursery grounds for Colorado pike minnow and other fish in the lower river. In considering and referencing my opinions in this, it considered those factors. And I think it's correct in my deposition that whether it's a legal designation or not doesn't matter. It is the fact that what's important is what would the potential impact be on those types of critical habitats, backwater, side channels, et cetera.
I have no further questions at this time.
Thank you, Ms. Swanson. Mr. Ms. Alves, any questions?
No questions. Thank you, Your Honor, for asking.
Mr. Wright?
Yes, Your Honor.
Just probably more a point of clarification. Blue Castle has not held out your work for preparation of these applications as the final word on the impact of the Green River that this project might have, correct?
Correct.
There's still an entire NEPA process and the environmental impact statement process still to come should the applications be approved, right?
Correct.
Nothing further, thank you.
Thank you. Anything further on those items, Ms. Swanson?
Excuse me, just really quickly.
Take your time.
Mr. Wright just referred to additional work that you anticipate will be done. Sorry, I stepped away again. Mr. Wright just referred, I believe, to additional work that you anticipate will be done as to the environmental impact of the proposed diversion on the Green River, correct?
Correct.
Are you currently engaged in performing any of that work?
No.
Are you aware of anyone else retained by Blue Castle who is engaged in that work?
I believe I referred Mr. Ed O'Borney and BioWest at the time initially as someone that would be qualified to collect fisheries data from the lower Green River. That's all I'm aware of.
You're not aware of whether they have actually begun such work or engaged?
You know, I'd be honest, I think Ed mentioned something to me that they had been collecting, but I can't remember specifically.
And regardless, none of that work came into... None of that work that may be being done has had any bearing on your analysis that you presented today.
That is correct.
Okay. I have nothing
further. Thank you. Anything else from anyone? Dr. Harden, you may step down. Thank you very much for your help.